We know that you rely on our team at 1A and everyone at NPR to provide up-to-the-moment updates, context, and discussion on the news that's happening all over the world in what can feel sometimes like a never-ending barrage of major issues that require a lot of attention and focus and understanding and concentration. And now, we are relying on you. Every penny you put into us is put into making this service better for you. Individual donors like you are the single largest source of station funding. So join those who believe in our journalism and our commitment to the facts and civil, calm conversation. Go to donate.npr.org/1A to make a gift. Your financial support connects you and me to the rest of the world. That's part of our mission here at 1A and NPR, to bring you conversations with the best writers, thinkers, business leaders, politicians on the subjects that really matter. If you value that service and the place that public radio has in your heart and in your mind, then please show us. Visit donate.npr.org/1A to give. Thanks. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The wildfires that tore through California this month are finally contained, but the death toll continues to rise, and thousands of homes are destroyed. Those include the home of Tammy Collins in Paradise, California.
What took a lifetime to accumulate and appreciate was incinerated in minutes, and we have nothing but a tiny, tiny pile of ash remaining.
Ms. Collins is among the thousands who lost not only their homes, but everything in them. What value do those things have? After accounting for the safety of your loved ones, how do you mourn the loss of possessions? A member of our 1A text club wrote us, "My parents lost their home to a house fire when I was 20 years old. I had just moved back home from college and lost everything. As a result, I am not overly attached to material things. However, after my parents' house fire, the local volunteer firefighters returned to the house the next day and sifted through the ashes until they found two of my rings. I'm still grateful to them, almost 40 years later." Today, let's focus on the objects we care about, why we care about them, and what happens when we lose them. That's just ahead after you hear this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Showtime and the new Showtime documentary series, Enemies, the President, Justice, and the FBI. From Academy Award winner Alex Gibney, Enemies is a true political thriller. The series goes from Watergate, Iran-Contra, and Whitewater to the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, examining the parallels, the similarities, and the connections of today. Enemies, the President, Justice, and the FBI starts streaming this Sunday only on Showtime.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining us from New York is Bill Shapiro, the co-author of What We Keep. 150 people share the one object that brings them joy, magic, and meaning. Bill, welcome to 1A.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
Joining us from Portland, Oregon is Christian Burgess, the director of the Disaster Distress Helpline. Christian, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And at Houston Public Media, Jennifer Battle is the Crisis Services Program Director at the Harris Center for Mental Health and Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. She is also a survivor of Hurricane Harvey. Jennifer, glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Bill Shapiro, let me start with you. Your book, What We Keep, it's this collection of testimonials and images of people's most prized possessions and the stories behind them. They come from an array of people from many walks of life, and I'd love you to talk us through a few of them in a moment. But first, can you give us a sense of what inspired the book? As I understand it, it had to do with your experiences living in Brooklyn, dealing with Hurricane Sandy back in 2012, right?
Right. There was actually a few threads that led to the idea behind the book. One was Superstorm Sandy in 2012, where we saw the neighborhood, Red Hook, right next to ours, totally flooded, totally swamped. And we saw, you know, artists and the people who live there take years and years of their work and their inspiration and have to leave it on the curb completely soaked. But it was also you know, when you see the photos like I did of the Syrian refugees in the early days fleeing from their homes, this particular photo that really stayed with me, a woman, a mother, and her child in her arm and a small burlap sack. And I saw the picture and I wondered, you know, what do you take in that sack when you're never going to see your home again? You take your clothes, maybe a little food, but do you take one object that really will remind you of the home from where you came?
We asked some of you to send us your most prized possessions and the stories behind them. You'll find those pictures and stories online at the1a.org, also on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. We also included the favorite objects of writer Cheryl Strayed and comedian Hassan Minhaj, as well as some members of 1A's staff. Bill, were there any patterns, any trends that you found among the things that people considered their most prized possessions or among their most prized possessions?
Well, the one thing is that of the hundreds of people that we spoke to from, like you said, all walks of life, famous and not, nobody, not one person chose something of monetary value. You know, it's like our hearts are not accountants. We go for the meaning over the monetary. So, you know, there were rings, but they were not chosen because of the value, but because of the sentimental value. But what was really interesting was that it wasn't so much the pattern of the thing, of the object itself, but the story behind it and the connection that it represented. That's where the real heart in this book is.
Let me get to our other two guests, Christian and Jennifer, and learn a little bit more about your organizations. Christian Burgess, you are the director of the Disaster Distress Helpline. Give us a little bit more of a sense of what the helpline is, how it's funded, who it serves, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, the Disaster Distress Helpline is the nation's only crisis hotline, which is 1-800-985-5990. That's dedicated to supporting survivors, responders, and anyone impacted by natural or human-caused disasters. Our services, they're free, confidential, multilingual, and always available, 24/7, 365. We're funded by the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and administered by my parent company, which is the not-for-profit Vibrant Emotional Health.
Jennifer, tell us about the Harris Center in Houston, Texas. You helped a lot of survivors of Hurricane Harvey with mental health support. Is that right?
Absolutely. The Harris Center is the largest provider of public mental health and intellectual disability services in the state of Texas, and of course being here in Houston, which is Harris County. And yeah, during the Hurricane Harvey last fall, we had a team of folks who stayed on site at our crisis line to work in partnership with Christian's program and our own services here in our city to answer. We answered over 2,000 calls during the 5 days that Houston was underwater, just to be available and be a listening ear and help people do that immediate crisis recovery work that needed to happen.
We heard from quite a few listeners who are hurricane survivors. And Jennifer, you survived Hurricane Harvey as well. I understand that your family, that you lost your home in the storm. Were you able to preserve any valuables, though?
We did. And again, what Bill said was absolutely true. You know, the hearts are not accountants. And, you know, we got our kids out of town before the storm came so that my husband and I could sort of focus on doing what we could to preserve what we could. And, you know, my heart is so much with the folks that are losing their homes to fires, because at least with the flood, we were still able to, you know, save some things. And, you know, all the things that were up in the attic, you know, right, they were fine. A lot of those memorable things that Bill talks about. So I feel so much gratitude to still be able to have some of those things. And again, such gratitude to work in a city that is so loving and supportive, and to work in an organization where we can really talk to people who lost even more than our family did.
We heard from a number of you who survived various natural disasters. A member of the 1A Text Club writes, "We had to leave our home due to Hurricane Florence. We've gone from a 2,000 square foot home to a 1,300 square foot apartment with 4 kids and a dog. The one item I did insist on going back for was our musical instruments. I always want music to be a part of our lives. Memories are irreplaceable, but making music is a sure way to create memories wherever we are." Here's another listener who left us a note about dealing with disaster. Here's what George left in our inbox.
Hi, this is George from Granville, Michigan. And in April of 2016, our home caught fire due to a freak accident. Thankfully, no one was at home. The fire department was able to stop the fire, but between the flames, smoke, soot, and water, everything in the home was lost. We've since been able to rebuild our home and our lives. When we tell people about it, they say, well, it's just stuff, which is true, but it was our stuff. Not a day goes by that we don't think of something we lost. One thing we did pay to have restored was a large set of china. This set was purchased in Japan by my wife's father as he rotated out of Vietnam at the end of the war. The china could never be replaced, and neither could those memories.
George, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. Glad you were able to get that china restored. Christian Burgess, I wonder if I could come to you after George's story. I mean, obviously we think about people's physical safety right after a disaster, but this idea that it was just stuff, I feel like that's one of those sympathetic platitudes that people who did not go through the disaster say to the traumatized to try to make it better. But I feel like that just doesn't help. It's not just stuff, is it?
No, absolutely, it's not. I think that when we think of stuff or possessions, the way I break it down is that there we have functional possessions, so appliances and our car and many of the things that help us get work and earn a living, perform daily tasks. And then we also have sentimental possessions, which are part of our lives, and they contain our memories and our sense of self, our sense of connection, our sense of belonging. And so when we, and sometimes they overlap, of course. Just yesterday in the New York Times, I was reading about some survivors of the wildfire. And there was an older gentleman who lost everything but his car. And it was, he actually had the car towed out of the devastation because he felt like his car was a part of his family. He had so much of a connection to it, and it was a vintage car at that. So I think that when we lose sentimental possessions, it's a disruption to our sense of self. It unmoors us and makes us feel like that we've lost a part of ourselves, almost like a limb. And so that can take quite some time to recover from.
For the book What We Keep, Bill spoke to comedian Hasan Minhaj, who we've also had recently on this program to speak about his new Netflix comedy show, Patriot Act. Minhaj said that his most prized possession is a page from his journal with little doodles and notes. But those doodles and notes show the first time he thought up the concept for what would become his Netflix comedy special called Homecoming King. And that great idea, as he tells it, was buried among lots of not-so-great ideas.
I can't believe this thing that I wrote years ago opened up this really great new possibility for me of sort of combining stand-up comedy and storytelling and bringing that to stage, and it informed so much of my work going forward. I never want to sort of forget that. When I'm in a rut, just be like, wow, you know, tomorrow you could end up just doodling or drawing or writing down a thought that can open up a whole new world of possibilities. And also when I've written something, sort of like, I'm like, ah, wow, that's game-changing. Just remind yourself, you're going to write the dumbest idea ever.
That's comedian Hasan Minhaj talking about the journal entry with the doodles that became the comedy special Homecoming King. You can find a picture of that journal page and some of the prized possessions that you sent us online at the1a.org. Bill, I wonder if you could tell us about one object that you consider most valuable, something that's one of your prized possessions.
Well, there is a sign, a hand-drawn sign that I made in 1986 when I was hitchhiking with my friend Fred through East Germany and Germany, and it was when I was in college. And the sign, it says in German, anywhere. I think the word is Engelwog or something like that. I don't speak German. And basically, just, you know, by saying anywhere, we wanted to go anywhere. It didn't matter. It didn't matter where we were going or sort of who we were going with or when we got there. And I keep it for a simple reason, because after that moment in my life got more complicated, narrowed a bit. You know, there were mortgage payments and life insurance and all that stuff. And that is that sign is kind of like a North Star for me, for something that I want to remember, but also something that it inspires me to reach out to and catch again and you know, make a part of my life, the sense of going anywhere.
Yeah, I see the sign on our website. It's this kind of, looks like it's just written on regular lined yellow legal pad paper and big kind of, looks like you took a red pen and a blue pen and kind of scratched out the word irgendwo, which means anywhere.
Yeah, it was very pathetic. We just did it on the side of the road and my handwriting's terrible anyway. And there's, you know, it is of literally no value except to me.
It's legible though. Like it, and clearly it worked. It's got a little bit of the serial killer handwriting on it, but that's okay. You were trying to make a big sign that was legible from the road. And I'm sure when you look at that sign, I'm sure your mind flashes back to like, I was crazy at that time.
Well, it's going to go back to serial killer. So thanks a lot.
You know what I mean. It's that kind.
I know.
You know what I'm trying to say. Jennifer, let me come to you. I know you dealt with some tragedy in Hurricane Harvey, but there must have been certain items that you were able to save. As I understand it, there was a specific box that was damaged by floodwaters that you told a friend to look through for you to see what she could salvage, right?
Yes, I am. My hobby is a scrapbooker. So any of you, Betty, in your audience can imagine what my house looks like as far as the number of photos and paper and craft supplies. And so, but they're also not practical things that you can ever take with you if you're in a hurry. So I am very good at doing scrapbooks for my kids. I have two kids and they get a book every year from birthday to birthday. I've not been so good at my own stuff. So I've had this box of plans, right, of all the things, the stuff that I've had since I was a kid, every job I've ever had through college, through grad school, every award I'd won or presentation I gave at a conference or what have you, thinking someday I would put all this together in a scrapbook and have that available for my kids or grandkids or what have you. And it was up in pretty much the top of my closet, so I still haven't quite figured out how it ended up. I'm guessing the water, the rush of the water somehow pushed it out. And when we came in, when we had almost like 4.5 or so feet of water in our house and came home and there it was kind of laying, it was in a plastic box, but when it fell, the lid came off and I couldn't even touch it. I just knew I was pretty sad. So one of my really fantastic close friends, Lisa, you know, was first at the scene trying to help us figure it out. And I just asked her, could you just take it home? I don't want to know what you can't save. Like, if it's all gone, it's all gone. But if there's anything in there that you could save, please, you know, do it. So she and another wonderful friend, Joanna, I have this great photo of Lisa's kitchen with, you know, string and clips hanging paper to dry. And she did all this research online about how to save photos and how to save paper. And they saved a lot. And, you know, it looks well used and well loved more than it maybe did before. But they're, thanks to them and their ingenuity and that, you know, concrete thing, you know, people want to help. And that's the beautiful thing about community. And, you know, we can't get away necessarily from natural disasters. Those are things that will continue to happen. And so what we know we can do as a community is figure out how to love each other and how to support each other.
Yeah.
And that was a very concrete example.
Quite a few folks sent us comments about the people who rush in during disaster, include some who are firefighters, for which we're very grateful. One listener in the 1A Text Club writes, I'm a retired fireman. I responded during 9/11, Katrina, and Sandy. What always got me at fires was seeing photos in the ashes. I always tried to collect them during overhaul and leave them by what used to be the front for the family to find when they came back. Connor tweeted, when I was first trained as a volunteer firefighter, my team was taught that we should do all we can to salvage clothes and photographs from the wreckage once the fire was out. Years and years later, victims always seem most grateful for these two items above all things. Bill, could you respond to that? Are there certain kinds of items that you and your research found people tended to be the most grateful for either having kept or having salvaged?
Well, it really depends on the connection to the person, because a certain kind of memory, a certain connection to another person, whoever gave it to you, could be wrapped around any object at all. You know, we came across a guy who had a bottle opener, a generic $1.99 unremarkable bottle opener that was given to him by his grandmother, who, it turns out, was the largest marijuana importer in the country during the 60s and 70s.
Wait, so, what?
Yes. That was a story he never told anybody else. And when you look at this very generic bottle opener, you would never expect that. But for him, that was his connection to her. So some person may have that connection through a ring or a photo, but for him, it was this bottle opener. You know, but I was really touched by what Jennifer just said about her friends and the and her scrapbook and the photos. And what's really interesting to me is that now all those objects that she has this whole other layer of meaning and memory and emotion wrapped around it that wasn't even there before, which is the love and caring of her friends and community.
Many of the objects that folks wrote to us about were stuffed animals. One member of the 1A Text Club sent us an image of her diabetes bear named Catherine. It is on our website, and it is absolutely adorable. She wrote, "I got her the summer I gave myself my first insulin shot. Fast forward 18 years, and I still have her with me. She's been to Rome, LA, San Francisco, Ontario, Delaware, and every place in between. She's no longer soft and fluffy, but worn and well-loved. Her mouth is coming unstitched, her dress is torn, but she's still beautiful and will always be the one item I will save." Christian, it's amazing the value that comforting objects have, amazing but not surprising, for children, particularly in the aftermath of a disaster.
That's right. I think kids are pretty resilient overall. And when it comes to possessions, obviously, they haven't necessarily had a lifetime of accumulating things like adults have, and that was mentioned earlier in the program. And so they don't have that sense of having to start over. But kids do attach fairly quickly to objects in their childhood that bring them comfort and bring them a sense of stability, whether it's a stuffed animal or a blanket or some other object. And so I think that when kids lose those types of objects, and it could be young kids or older kids, I think that it helps for parents to give them extra assurance. You can't assume that just because you're going to get them a new toy or a new stuffed animal that they're going to recover more quickly because of that, because it will still take time for them to transfer those emotions that they had in those past objects into a new object. But they'll get there. They just need time. They need a little bit of patience. But kids mostly, of course, they just want that adult presence and that caregiving presence more than they want attachment to possessions. So parents and caregivers should just keep that in mind during the recovery process.
Another member of the 1A Text Club wrote, "I can't send you a picture of my prized possession because my ducky, my favorite stuffed animal growing up, was lost in the Waldo Canyon fire in Colorado Springs in 2012. These fires are real. If you're anywhere near a fire or evacuation zone, take these events seriously and prepare for the worst. I'll forever regret my mistake." Jennifer, I wonder what you encounter in terms of talking to people about surviving a disaster as it relates to possessions. I feel like there's this kind of split perspective we have on objects. You know, there are certain things that we know are valuable, but there's also kind of a negative connotation to holding on to things, you know, to objects, whether it's, you know, Leo's blue blanket from the producers or, you know, just this idea of being a hoarder, that something is your precious that you just can't let go of, or, you know, the pocket watch from Pulp Fiction. I mean, there is this connotation about having a thing, this object that is just so important and you just can't let it go, that is not positive. And I think that can make some people feel uncomfortable about attaching meaning to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think that Bill's point was also well done in the sense that it really depends on what type of, and Christian's point as well, about what type of relationship people have with that. You know, in our organization, we're working with people who might have a history of anxiety or a history of depression, or who are caregivers for folks who might have an autism spectrum disorder or something along those lines. And so in cases where you can find immediate comfort or support or sense of safety around an object, it could be, you know, even something as simple as just something you can hold on your hand to give you a sense of grounding, the pocket watch idea or what have you, sometimes, you know, a rock or the blanket or a tactile sense of connection is key to not only the long-term recovery impacts of being able to have something that sort of connects you from past to present to future, but also just, again, in that sense of grounding, no matter where you are, you know, in our community, as in many of the other communities that you're speaking about, you know, many people had to leave their homes. They don't even have homes anymore. They're staying in shelters. They're staying with friends. They're staying in their cars. So to have something that you can touch and that you can feel and that you can see that gives you a sense of comfort or immediate stress release is so valuable. And I would hope as a society we would kind of let go of some of that idea of judgment and really look for more of a sense of community and support.
Yeah, I certainly hear you on that, Jennifer. Bill Shapiro, how do you see it? Absent the presence of some kind of a disaster that kind of throws all of our possessions into chaos, how do you see that kind of dual perspective we have culturally on prized possessions?
So putting the idea of the hoarder all the way to the side, because
right.
we're not talking about that.
Right.
I really couldn't agree with Jennifer more, especially when it comes to a tactile item that if you have it in your hand and you know that your mother and your mother's mother and your mother's mother also held it in their hands at some point, you know, 150 years ago, there's some deep connection to that. And it really, you know, instead of making it feel like, oh, this object is so important, what it actually does is it sort of puts you in the human scale of life. And if anything, makes you smaller and more humble, but makes you connected to, you know, as one of the people in our book said, the ongoing pageant of human drama. And I think there's something very comforting in that.
What if you left a note in our inbox that speaks to the role communities play in recovering lost things? Jennifer, I know that you touched on this. Here is that note from our inbox.
Hi, my name is Karen Kobeck, and I live in Wenatchee, Washington, an area that's extremely wildfire prone. And about 3 years ago, we had a wildfire come through and burn about 30 homes. And my mother-in-law nearly lost her home in that fire. And one of the things that struck me was that she had said she would have been devastated had she lost all of her handwritten, handed down over the generation recipes, and she wouldn't have thought to have grabbed them. And so I thought that was a really interesting thing to note. And one of the things that we did as a community was put together a cookbook for the people who lost their homes and collected recipes from all the community members of their, you know, really treasured handed down recipes. And to this day, they're still coming up to me and saying thank you.
That's awesome, Karen. Thanks very much for calling. By the way, Wenatchee, Washington is about 90-plus miles east of Seattle. It's kind of on the eastern side of the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest. Christian, talk a little bit about how the crisis counselors at the Disaster Distress Helpline help people kind of manage the trauma of losing possessions. I know we have to pause in a moment, but how do they kind of get that conversation going?
Sure. Well, the first thing that we do is, and which is really the most powerful, is that we listen. Which can seem simple, but especially in the aftermath of a disaster where survivors and others impacted often feel like their needs and their feelings are getting lost in the chaos of recovery. And oftentimes survivors are also encountering those types of reactions where people might have good intentions, but because there's just a focus on getting basic needs restored, right. they don't feel like they have an outlet where they can talk about the pain of loss of things like sentimental possessions.
Hey, Christian, can I hold you right there? We're up against clearly one of my prized possessions should be a timer. I'm sorry for that, but I will
sure.
let you finish your thought in just a moment. I want to make sure we have a chance to hear this music. Alex Carlson sent us a picture of his guitar. It had been stolen and then returned to him 5 years later. Here is a bit of him playing that guitar with his band Trigger 5. This song is called Cheat and Walk. We'll get to more of your stories in a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Hey, just a quick reminder, your support is what keeps 1A and NPR on the air. We provide that rare space that promotes open dialogue, where everyone feels welcome and everyone feels heard. We are in no one's pocket but the pocket of those who keep us going. That's you. So please, make a donation at donate.npr.org/1A. Thanks. Back now to our conversation with Jennifer Battle, Bill Shapiro, and Christian Burgess. Christian, let me let you finish your comment before we keep going.
Sure. Well, going back to what our crisis counselors with the Disaster Distress Helpline are offering folks, whether they're calling regarding the wildfires in California or other disasters, in listening to their stories, we're also offering validation that what they're feeling is okay. We're normalizing those reactions and letting them know that these that mourning the loss of possessions or whatever the reactions may be are commonly experienced by people who have been touched by disaster. And we're also exploring healthy coping, making sure that people feel like they have the resources they need in order to bounce back. We're helping callers regain a sense of control over a situation that feels very much out of control. And I think that in the immediate aftermath of disasters, oftentimes the focus is on those functional possessions, is helping people to access community resources and disaster relief provider organizations that can help them get some things back one at a time, whether it's clothing or certain appliances, et cetera. But then over time, when months go by and even years after a disaster, what our crisis counselors are also doing then is continuing to listen, because sometimes it really does, some of the totality of loss and other mental health concerns that are triggered by the loss of possessions, especially when it is everything that a person owns, sometimes these feelings don't surface for months or even years after a disaster. So our crisis counselors are also helping people to process feelings in the long-term recovery stage after a disaster as well.
By the way, Christian, could you give that helpline number one more time?
Sure. It's the Disaster Distress Helpline is 1-800-985-5990.
And is it just on by phone, or are there also online components? Mostly by phone?
It's mostly by phone. We also offer a texting option, which is that people can text the keyword talk with us. That's TALKWITHUS all together to the short code 66746. And so when they text talk with us to 66746, they're connected via text with the crisis counselor live. And that's also available 24/7. And so they can have a texting session with one of our crisis counselors.
Valerie commented on our Facebook page, "I just evacuated for Hurricane Michael." That's the hurricane that hit the Florida panhandle last month. "I just evacuated for Hurricane Michael. Since I work in the field of disaster response, we are trained to have go kits and preparedness plans. My cats went to boarding a safe distance away at their vet, where they also have an emergency preparedness plan. Aside from my go kit, I took a tote bag of keepsakes, including my dad's dog tags and medals. I looked back and said goodbye to my home. I had to go do the job I love and trained for." By the way, speaking of Hurricane Michael, Florida's Division of Emergency Management, just so you know, updated the disaster toll from that in a briefing yesterday. The death toll from Hurricane Michael is now up to 43 people after more deaths were confirmed in Bay, Jackson, Washington, Leon, Franklin, and Wakulla counties up in the Florida panhandle. Jennifer, could you react to Valerie's comment? It seems like because she was trained in disaster response, she knew where to go, and she'd already thought through the keepsakes that she had to keep and where to put them and how to grab them.
Absolutely. And, you know, part of any community that is at risk for storms, the City of Houston and the Harris County Management District here, they always put out information ahead of storms, encouraging people to have go kits available and ready, and some put some thought into what they need to do to stay safe. And so we do a lot of that, you know, with my team, when we had to make the decision to go into what we call disaster mode. My team is all aware that that we're a 24-hour program and that people need to be available. And so I have never in the 15 years that I've worked at the Harris Center had to compel anybody to be on our disaster team. These are people, just like your caller said, you know, who are ready to go. This is what we're trained to do and this is what we're here for. So I had 20 folks who were at the Harris Center in our crisis line for 5 days who brought backpacks and sleeping bags and were there taking those calls and talking to folks. And I think that that's part of the work that we do, right? Which is, you know, there's plenty of people in our communities, you know, first responders, EMS, you know, nurses, dispatchers, folks that work in 911, what have you. And so I always send out encouragements through social media when everybody else is kind of talking about evacuating or what have you, saying, you know, please keep in mind that there's still people at work right now.
Right.
And we're here to help you in whatever it is that you need. And, you know, we still took the same volume of calls during those 5 days where our city was basically shut down that we take on a normal day. And that was because people just didn't know what else to do. You know, 911 can be overwhelmed. And, you know, people are calling because they're scared. We had, you know, with this situation being a flood, you know, there were people that were trapped and they were scared and they didn't know. And so, you know, obviously at a crisis line, we don't have a boat to deploy. But we do can often just help people, as Christian said, go through some of those calming techniques and kind of say, where are you right now? What's going on? And what we found a lot of those times was that people's weren't actually flooded yet, but they were just so scared.
Yeah.
That some of what we could do is really kind of help set expectations and help people calm and, you know, work through some of that anxiety so that they could focus on being prepared and getting those bags together and knowing what to actually do should it come to that.
And hey, speaking of being prepared, there's a great website called ready.gov. If you've never been to it, it's filled with excellent disaster preparedness information. If you go to ready.gov and click plan ahead at the top, there's a PDF that will teach you how to safeguard critical documents and valuables, what to think about. It's basically a checklist. Do you have a passport? Do you have medications you need to preserve? Pictures, memorabilia, photos, mementos. It's kind of a guide for helping to think about disaster way before disaster strikes. It's ready.gov and click plan ahead in the upper right. Let's get to another message that one of our listeners left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Amy from Fenton, Michigan. I lost my home to a house fire in January of 2010. My friends and family sifted through the ashes and rubble for 2 days to recover my grandmother's wedding ring. Other than my hero dog, Tanner, who warned me of the fire even before the smoke alarms went off, it was the only thing saved from our home. Although this was an incredibly challenging time for me, my overall feeling is one of gratitude for all of the amazing support that I received during this challenging time.
Amy, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. And Christian, I'd love for you and Bill to react to one thing in particular that Amy said in that note where she said, my overall feeling is one of gratitude. Christian, let me start with you on that, particularly because it aligns with something you help survivors with in your work, what you refer to as post-disaster growth. What is post-disaster growth?
Yes, well, and the caller certainly exemplified that. After a disaster or any kind of traumatic event, the goal ultimately is to integrate that experience into your overall life story. And so during recovery, particularly with help from loved ones, for some people that also might include accessing behavioral health resources in their community like a therapist or some other crisis counseling program, et cetera. But over time, you're able to look back on the event and you develop a healthy perspective about what happened and how it led to where you are now. And so, again, it just becomes a part of your overall story. And so it's post-disaster growth, or sometimes referred to as post-traumatic growth. But the important thing to remember is that we can't rush that process. Recovery takes time. For some people, it may take months. For others, it may take years. But the important thing is to remember that it is possible and that ultimately that's what we're doing with the Disaster Distress Helpline and what services like the Harris Center provides and others in the community are helping people to move along on that process of emotional recovery.
Bill, did you encounter any stories in your research for this book that would reflect this post-disaster growth?
Well, I think what can happen is that this item, this object that survives the fire or the flood, the single item, can become imbued with almost a more sacred feeling to it. You know, everything was lost except for this ring. And we can start to imbue some special meaning into that ring. And maybe it even becomes more powerful or talismanic than it would have in the past. And it becomes more special a story we tell our kids and our children's children.
One member of the 1A Text Club wrote, "I lost everything in Hurricane Katrina. The loss is so devastating on so many levels and in so many ways. But every year, the thing that gets me is when we decorate the Christmas tree. All of the little macaroni ornaments that my kids made in school with their photos on them are gone forever. It hurts my heart every year. I know exactly what all of these poor people are going through right now and what they're going to go through in the months and years to come. Recovery is a process. I wish them Godspeed." Holly wrote on our Facebook page, "I'm a personal archivist. I've had many clients tell me that the main reason they have their photos, tapes, etc. digitized is because they're afraid of losing those precious memories if something bad happens." Holly, I'm glad you brought that up, because quite a few folks talked about the digital component of keepsakes, including Jim, who tweeted, "With only 2 minutes to react, once the family is safe, I'd be grabbing the portable hard drive on my desk that's stuffed full of photos and videos. And yeah, I know, off-site backup." Yes, Jim. Space in the cloud costs nothing these days. iCloud, OneDrive, Google Drive, come on, it's dollars a month. But Bill, how does that factor in? The fact that a lot of the things that we hold dear aren't really things at all. They just kind of live in the cloud.
Well, so that's actually a really interesting trend, and it's one of the things that led us to make this book in the first place, because people have fewer things than they did in the past for the very reason you just said, record albums, gone, all in the cloud. But I think the other point is that people obviously have lots of pictures of their family, but they may want to take photographs of the ring, the bottle opener, you know, the key that they got from their grandparent, these things that are very ordinary objects, imbued with sentimental meaning. Take photos of those, and you'll always have them.
Another reminder in terms of the value of preparing early. One listener commented on our website, the1a.org, "Please explain to people that the only priority, not top, but only priority, is to evacuate people in case of fire. I have had this hammered into my head through military training, citizen emergency training, corporate safety training, and childcare training. People who try to gather up stuff can and do die from that decision." Some of you did mention to us some treasured objects that weren't actually objects, at least not a physical one. One of them was an audio recording. Listen.
"Now these two little quail lived out on the desert."
You mean could no one see them?
That's right. They lived under the sagebrush and in the sand.
That was a recording from 1967 that Tammy, who's from Indiana, Pennsylvania, sent us of her late father, whom she called a superb storyteller. In an email, Tammy wrote, "My most cherished object is a recording of my father's voice, the only one I possess. The recording includes interruptions on the part of my sister and me, ages 5 and 3, respectively. Everyone, record the voices of anyone you love. After their passing, these precious people will live on in a more vivid and immediate way than visual evidence can convey." Good advice, Tammy. I am actually going to do my grandmother's oral history over the Christmas break. She just turned 100 this year, and she has the best memory of anybody in our family. So we're going to make sure that we get her on tape. I like Tammy's advice. Speaking of advice, we should allow each of you to give us some before our time is up. Jennifer, what advice do you have for people who want to prepare now in the event that they have to evacuate, either with the physical objects or just mentally and emotionally for the toll that disaster can take?
I just think that idea of knowing that there are resources out there, and that in those moments where it can feel very dark and you feel very alone, that you are not. Programs, the crisis lines that are out there, knowing and how to have people around who know how to access things like FEMA and insurance and what have you. You don't have to know how to do everything. Let us help you. That just keep the faith and keep hope alive and right. Use the resources that are there.
Oh, by the way, Jennifer, how can people reach the Harris Center if they need you?
They are welcome to go onto our website, which is theharriscenter.org, and they can see all of our different programs and services that are available.
Gotcha. Christian, before we go, what advice would you have for folks to prepare for their keepsakes before disaster strikes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of great advice has been given already, and I was moved by what Bill said about taking photos of possessions, and that's certainly something I think I need to do. I think along with that, I would encourage people to also, in addition to taking those photos, is to write about them as well. Write about how that possession came into your belongings, and similar to the stories we've heard in this, just make sure you document those stories as well. Because I think that in addition to what it looks like, you need to also capture those other memories.
And briefly, Bill, before we go?
I would say take a video along the lines of what Christian said. You know, have this object in your hand and say, why do you value it? Why do you carry it with you? What does this hold that you want to teach your children or share with the world? How come you don't want to forget it? How does this connect you to something bigger than yourself?
Bill Shapiro, his book is called What We Keep. 150 people share the one object that brings them joy, magic, and meaning. Bill, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Christian Burgess, the director of the Disaster Distress Helpline. Christian, thanks.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Battle, the Crisis Services Program Director at the Harris Center. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Today's program was produced by Avery Kleinman. You can learn more about her and our priceless staff at theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.